There is one absolute rule I adhere to with this podcast, a hardline rule that I will never break when it comes to guests. I gotta like them. So bringing legendary rocker Sammy Yaffa onto the podcast was a no-brainer. In fact, when the opportunity presented itself, I jumped at the chance like a dog on Alpo. Why wouldn't I want Sammy on the podcast? His rock and roll resume reads like someone's wet dream. Member of Hanoi Rocks, member of New York Dolls, Madonna, Jet Boy, Joan Jett, Jesse Malin, Compulsions, and even Murphy's Law. We could probably do multiple episodes on each one. But what has really got me thinking about Sammy lately is his incredible award-winning travelogue television show, Soundtracker, now in its third season. Here, Sammy travels the world, digs deep, and pulls focus onto a variety of music scenes, from Argentina to Ethiopia, from Ethiopia to Turkey, Turkey to Jamaica, and you name it, Sammy will be there. But what's attractive and inviting is Sammy's approach. He doesn't introduce you to these places and their music like some stodgy, stiff university professor or some condescending world traveler who's been there and done that. His approach is filled with humility and reverence for the music and the culture. His genuine curiosity and absorption and respect is charming and contagious. Sammy is the perfect guide to turn someone onto music because watching Soundtracker, you trust him. You like him. Your music library is guaranteed to expand after watching just a few episodes. Much like Anthony Bourdain does with his travelogue shows on food, Sammy does through music. Showing viewers, no matter what cultural barriers may appear to be between us, we are all bound together by music. Now look, that's not usually how I talk. It sounds kind of hippie, but I genuinely believe it. I just don't usually speak it. No matter where I've traveled all over the world, I've been received graciously and respectfully despite whatever language or cultural or political hurdles there are. And that's because of a mutual love for music. Don't think this hasn't hit me over and over again. I've been in situations where it was harder for me to ask someone where the toilet was than it was for me to sing the opening of MC5's Kick Out the Jams and have everyone understand what that was. Music is binding. Now, the events that led to this episode are a bit surreal. Back in January, JC and I went on a whirlwind promotional press tour for our new album, Wildcat. We traveled to England, to France, Germany, Sweden, Holland, and Italy. When I finally hit European shores, I noticed on my Netflix account, Sammy's Soundtracker series appeared. This is because, as most of you probably know, Netflix have different shows available depending on the territory. Back in Canada, we're unable to watch Soundtracker on Netflix. And in Europe, you can't watch It's So Easy, Duff McKagan's documentary that I'm actually in. So when I saw Soundtracker, I wasted no time downloading the show. I watched the first season and loved it. I was genuinely taken in and quietly noted how Sammy Yaffa has produced one of the best music-related shows I had seen on Netflix. A few weeks later, JC and I again traveled to Europe, this time to Helsinki, to do a day of press. We flew from Toronto to Frankfurt and then Helsinki, got off the plane, and immediately started doing interviews. We were jet-lagged, but it didn't stop us from yammering on about our new album. JC told me that our old pals, the Backyard Babies, were playing at the circus club that night, steps from our hotel. So we thought we'd drop by and say hello if we could stay up that late because of the jet lag. Luckily, we got our third wind and hung out with the B-Babies. When guitarist Dragan walked into the backstage area with Sammy Yaffa in tow, I thought I was dreaming. Here was Sammy, who I had been watching on my iPad in 2D, now in front of me in person. Add the jet lag to all this, and the moment became dreamlike. I know Sammy's Finnish and was in arguably Finland's greatest band, Hanoi Rocks. And I know he played with Dragon in Michael Monroe's band, so seeing him there isn't that much of a disconnect, but it's just that I had been looking at this guy's face and listening to this guy's voice in my head, and here he was in front of me. Like, I almost wished for it to happen. Of course, I started quoting the show back to him, like he needed to hear that. But one thing was obvious. Sammy needed to come on the podcast. Even Dragon suggested it. And coming from him, as a member of the Black Coffee Brigade, there could be no better recommendation. I'm interested when someone from the rock and roll community steps out of their comfort zone, steps up to the plate, and hits it out of the park. Add Soundtracker to the long list of home runs Sammy Yaffa has been able to achieve in his career. Hanoi Rocks is a diamond entry on his CV, but I'm most impressive by Soundtracker. If you're listening to this in Europe and you have Netflix, go. Watch it now and then come back. If you're in North America or anywhere else in the world where it's unavailable, I don't think it'll be too long a wait before it shows up. It's just too good a show to not spread further. I want to thank Skull Candy Headphones and Blue Mic Microphones for the support of this podcast. And thank you for listening to this. Please leave a rating and or a review if you like what you're hearing on the iTunes store, because it does help this podcast's profile. Okay, now, without further ado, here is my talk with the Untamed Finn, the rock and rolling globetrotter himself. Sammy Yaffa is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Leonard, Guinness, Danko's go out to love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. What do you see in my future? What are you reading in bones? She paused for a while, flashing alligator smile, and she told me, Danko Jones. And I said, the Danko Jones podcast makes me feel.
Gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready, because the Danko Jones podcast starts now!
Hey, Sammy.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, all right, man. Good to hear your voice.
Same thing.
Well, I saw you a couple of weeks back in, of all places, Helsinki.
Yeah,
you would expect to see you there, but you were up until recently based out of New York City.
Yeah, I was in New York for 20-25 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. And moved back to Europe a little over 2 years ago, almost three. I moved to Spain first, and then last summer I got a place in Helsinki and moved my books over here as well. So it's coming home after 36 years abroad. Prodigal son.
And it was a weird thing to bump into you, man, just as I was watching Soundtracker.
Yeah, right.
It's almost as if you came out of my iPad screen to say hello.
It was even weirder to see you, and I was at first like, hold on, is that Danko? What are they doing in Helsinki?
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Yeah, and I think the first thing I asked you was, is there going to be another season? Because when I was watching it, I didn't realize at the time that you are actually on your third season, because we don't get Soundtracker in Canada on Netflix here.
Yeah.
Which kind of sucks.
We're working on that. That's a shame. It came out in US on in California on a PBS, and then it was spread around to different states through PBS, but it was a really short run, and it's on Netflix in Scandinavia and 21 other countries. We're working on trying to get it worldwide like a fungus.
Well, JC's, he said backstage, he's seen it. Because he's got some other kind of online channel that he subscribes to or whatever. I don't know which one, but he'd seen Soundtracker. He told me about it. So when we were in Scandinavia back in January, we were in Sweden and we were in Germany and France. I grabbed it when I saw it on the Netflix there, when I was in their countries, I grabbed it, I downloaded it, I started watching it. And so, I was able to watch Soundtracker, but I didn't realize that you guys are already on the third season. So my first question to you was, are you going to do another season?
Yeah, we just got back from Israel and Palestine, and we went in January, went to Colombia, and we headed to Japan in April, and then to Russia and Ireland. So that's going to be the season 3.
Wow. Because, you know, the premise of the show already opens up to, Jesus, 10 seasons. I mean, you have the entire world as an episode. This could go on forever.
Yeah.
And what I found most appealing about it was, well, the way to bridge people together and cultures together and to bring people together is through food and through music. And I think Bourdain has that kind of corner of the market covered. He's got it cornered. And you have a connection with Anthony Bourdain. But when it comes to music, who would be the right guy? And watching Soundtracker, there's no doubt that you seem to be the perfect person for this kind of medium, for this kind of show. I can't think of anyone else. There's too much ego involved with other characters in music that overshadows maybe some of the subjects, but you come off very likable, very friendly to someone who's not even well aware of rock and roll or your history. You just come off as a very approachable, likable person.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I've been touring since I was 16, and you know, you learn to kind of communicate with whoever it is. It doesn't really matter if it's a big rock star or a, you know, janitor of the club or wherever you are. You know, it's just communication between people, and I think it's because I'm a musician. It's really easy for the musicians, whether I'm in Senegal or in Indonesia. It's kind of easier for them to open up instead of if I was you know, kind of like a regular interview guy. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, but for me, coming, you know, I'm a rock and roller. I don't know that when I see you. I just go, wow, that's Sammy Yafa from Hanoi Rocks, man. You know that dude? He fucking played with Johnny Thunders. Did you know that? Like, that is what I come to the table with. Whereas, you know, a lot of just regular people wouldn't attach that to you. So there's a little bit of that when I watch it going, wow, like you're able to like, yeah, just blend in, you know. That's what I come to the table when I watch it. So for me, I'm watching it from a kind of a different perspective. But that's when I took a step back. I realized, like, yeah, like he really strips any sort of rock and roll pretension and just tries to focus on the subject. A lot, you know, in rock and roll, a lot of ego is involved with that. As it should be to really be believable. But you managed to do a nice balancing act where you come off likable, but you're not this, you know, you're still this personality. I found it, that was the most interesting thing of watching Soundtracker that I took from being a Hanoi Rocks fan, being a rock and roll fan.
Yeah. Wow, that's cool to hear. You know what I mean? I'm just being myself, man. You know, I just happened to, it's basically what I've been doing all my life. I've been touring for 36 years, and whenever I go to a different city, I usually you know, at least I used to, that I just throw my bags on the bed in the hotel room and then go outside and look for what I can find, what kind of music I can find at the place where I'm at, whether it's Buenos Aires or whether it's Milan or whatever. And now I just have a camera crew with me, and right. And it's kind of, I'm really spoiled with this too. It's a kind of like selfish kind of thing, because I've always been into all kinds of music. It's never been only rock and roll. I've always been into all kinds of different things. I grew up my brother is a avant-garde free jazz saxophone player, and my dad was a big Django Reinhardt fan, and it's just, I grew up with a lot of music in my household, so I always kept my ears open, and I got this chance to do this. I just took it and ran with it.
You know, what's interesting about Soundtracker is the way you're able to infiltrate domestic scenes, real regional scenes. You're able to do it in a way that I don't think any other reporter would be able to. When I talked to Henry Rollins, I had a discussion about noise rock and noise music with him. And my question to Henry was, how do you even begin to get into a scene that doesn't have kind of like a guiding network for you? You know, like if you get into punk rock or heavy metal, you have all these guide points that help you navigate through the scene, and you can figure out what you like, what you don't like. In noise rock, it's so hard. In when it comes to all the scenes all over the world, how do you get into each scene? How do you do that? Is it a compilation that's put out by a label, or is it you know somebody? Like, what? How do you do that? Because you, Soundtracker really goes deep.
Yeah, it goes back to, because I've been touring for so damn long, so I know a lot of people all around the planet, and then most of the so-called fixers that we have in the program, they are either my friends or they're my friend's friends who has been recommended. Right. And most of them are in the music business, and most musicians that I know, they keep their ears and their feelers kind of open. They're not all musicians that I have been fixing. For example, in Brazil, it's a label owner from Pernambuco, from Recife, and I played with the New York Dolls in the jungle there with Bad Brains and New York Dolls, and the guy gave me a stack of CDs from his label, and I listened to him on the way back to New York, and it was the most amazing music I ever heard, and it just kind of stuck with me that when we decided to do Brazil, Brazil is too big for one program, so I decided to go to one region,
right.
And instead of doing the regular, normal Rio kind of thing, the samba and all that, I decided to go to Pernambuco and do a documentary about their music. Because it's not really well known, but it's deep as hell. It's really amazing music that comes out of there. And in Serbia, my fixer was a leader of this gypsy band that my other band, Maduana, played with when we opened up for Gogo Bordello. We did a little tour in California in 2007 or something like that. And when we started thinking about doing an episode on Serbian, like Balkan gypsy music, I thought of Dragan Ristic, and I gave him a call, and he was like, yeah, come on over here, I'll show you how the gypsies play, no problem. So it all goes down very kind of rootsy and like natural, down-to-earth kind of way.
You brought up the Serbia episode. What I loved about the Serbian episode was actually the focus on turbo folk.
Yeah. Oh, man. I didn't know you knew turbo folk, man. That's one of those things. Yeah.
I was really – what I loved about it was that is a kind of music, and there's similar kinds of musics in every kind of culture, you know, that's similar to that music. And, you know, coming from rock and roll and heavy metal and punk rock, I eschew that naturally. My ears go inward.
Yeah. But, yeah, I agree.
You know, and – but – you gave focus to that kind of music, and because of that, I was able to realize there's a history to that. There's a history there. There's a scene there. There's a, you know, all kinds of things that, for I think a lot of people in our position, we kind of just dismiss it as very shallow kind of music. But you gave it some weight, which I found very refreshing, And that's the kind of stuff I don't need to know about the history of punk rock anymore. We've got 20 documentaries on that.
Exactly.
I love that Turbo Folk. I really focused in on that. I thought that was so interesting because a lot of these kind of travelogue shows tend to focus on like, let's get down to the nitty gritty. No, let's focus on this thing that we all know exists, but you know, that's got this history to it as well. I found that was my favorite part of season one, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty far out, that whole scene, how it started from the suburbs and how it spread. And then it was funded by the warlords and the gangsters and all this kind of stuff. And it was really weird because we went to this barge on the Danube River to go and interview this the starlet that we found, Jupka Stivic. And it was like on one side of the dance floor was these bold guys with leather jackets.
Yeah.
And on the other side was this group of guys, bold guys with leather jackets. And I was like, what the hell's going on? And it was literally on the left, the cops, on the right was the gangsters that were hanging out in the same place. And neither one wanted to be in the camera. So we had to be really careful to only focus on stage. We couldn't like move the cameras to the left or to the right at all.
Right.
It was kind of heavy scene. It's a very weird thing that goes on down there with the but then Turbo Folk became kind of popular to the mainstream and all that, but in the beginning it was basically gangster music.
Yeah, that's a scene that I would never even try to get into. So, you know, watching Soundtracker, it kind of guides you and leads you into that scene, that something that, you know, I naturally is a natural aversion to. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on your second season, you said you managed to go to India and Jamaica. These are episodes I haven't seen. And yeah. I can only assume what was covered in those episodes since I haven't seen it. But you've traveled the world. In your travels, did you get to India? Like, who was your guide? What was your connection with India?
Well, we played with Hanoi Rocks in India in 1983. And it's the same thing with Brazil. India is too huge and too varied with music to be put into like even one season.
Yeah.
So we had to zone in on one area. And we decided to go to Rajasthan. I'd seen this movie in the 90s called Lacha Drum that tells you the movie tells you the story of the travel of the gypsy music. It starts from northern India and then travels westward and goes to Middle East and goes to Bulgaria, Romania, through North Africa, to Morocco and to southern Spain. And that movie started with the music of Rajasthan and kind of stuck with me. And we found a fixer through my ex-girlfriend, new people in movie business in Mumbai, who were producing Bollywood movies.
Wow.
We got in touch with those guys and we told them what we're looking for. And then they put us in contact with the local guy in Rajasthan who used to work for the Maharaja over there. So we sent a wish list of things that we'd like to cover, what styles of music and what tribes and what kind of drumming and what kind of flute playing and stuff like that. And these guys, they put it together amazingly, and we ended up staying every single hotel where we stayed. We stayed in a castle. I started thinking, like, what the hell is going on over here? It's the first place where we stayed. I stayed in the same room where the Queen Victoria, had stayed, and it was just really bizarre. And it turns out this guy, you know, he produces Bollywood movies over there, and he's, you know, used to work for Maharaja over there. That is like, I got the context. Don't worry about it. When you stay with me, you stay in a palace. That's amazing, man.
Wow.
It was absolutely one of the most amazing experiences I ever had. So we played we found this tribe that used to make their living out of snake charming. And they're considered like the forefathers of the gypsies. And because of the animal protection things, they can't practice their old profession anymore that they've been doing for thousands of years. They used to catch snakes from the huts and they were snake charmers, you know, with the flutes. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they adapted the snakes' dance into the ladies' dance. So they dressed their ladies in black and the ladies start imitating the movements of the snakes. And they had a band with a flute, I think violin and one drum. And when they started playing, I thought they were taking a piss out of us because it was like children playing, completely disjointed. Nobody was in rhythm. Nobody was playing a melody, but it was somehow, it kind of worked. And me and the director, we just looked at each other. It's like, you know, did we just get taken to cleaners? They just took the money and, you know, picked up some neighbor's instruments. And, you know. And so we asked them to play the same song again. And they played it exactly the same. It was the most weirdest, wow, fucked up thing I ever experienced, man. And then when I started listening to it, when I brought it home, and it's like some kind of weird Ornette Coleman of the Thar Desert or something. It's very, very weird stuff. It's really beautiful.
I think someone should go in there and record them and put it out. Some label should go in there then.
Yeah, we always record two songs, each artist, and we've been now cutting whole performances because the program is only 50 minutes, so we can only fit so much of each performance. And we've been spending now the last year putting together videos of this, of the entire performances and the entire interviews, so we can put them out. We're planning on starting a YouTube channel for Soundtracker, and that's where people can get even deeper into it.
I think one of the best performances, at least in season one that I've seen, was the Argentina episode with Ernesto Baffa, when you let that whole piece almost play. And I thought that was like one of the heaviest moments, because afterwards you said he had just lost his wife month previous. How heavy was that? I think you were like holding back the tears. That was one of the heaviest moments.
No, it was because we filmed him, we did the interview and he played us a song. And then after we finished, he asked, I was like, do you mind if I play one more song? And I was like, no, you can't. No, I was, of course, you know, and I just, you know, director kept the cameras rolling and we didn't know what he was going to do. And he just gave me he said, you know, ask for a note stand, and there was not a note stand anywhere to be seen. So he asked me to hold the partiture for him. And then he starts playing Ave Maria. And everybody in the room knew that he had just lost his wife. So it was really emotional. And there was like behind the cameras, there was maybe 7 or 8 old Argentinian guys, you know, standing, the bar owners and their buddies, who happened to be there, and they were all holding back their tears. It was really hardcore emotional moment.
I mean, you get that on film, you got to let that play out.
it's really amazing.
Now, you talking about India, the first thing that comes up into my head is danger. Has there ever been any kind of like moments where, whoa, that was a close call?
Yeah, we've been to the favelas in Pernambuco and literally we interviewed and filmed this old hardcore punk band and I was going to go across the street just to go and get a water, and when I started walking across the street, the leader of the band he just put his bass down and just started running after me, and he was like, no, turn back. And I was like, what? He said, like, look, you don't know where you are, and even just going across the street to get a water, you're not safe, so one of us has to come with you. And in Turkey, we were filming this young gypsy rapper group in one of the worst ghettos in Istanbul, and we did these city shots afterwards, and we started walking up the street with the camera guy. And suddenly one of the guys, he came back and he just said, turn around. And we're like, why? He was like, just don't ask. Turn around. Let's go back to the van and get out of here. And what had happened was that the next corner, there were about 15 guys with guns waiting for somebody because there had been a murder in that area the night before. One of the drug dealers had been killed, and they heard that the guy who had shot him is coming to that area, back to that area.
Oh my God.
And they were waiting for him, and we ended up smack in the middle of this whole thing. So we just had to kind of turn around and get back in the van and get the hell out of there. It's been some weird situations, definitely.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, with all your experience touring in rock and with all rock bands, you know how that experience is. When you're doing the touring for Soundtracker, even though you have, I'm assuming, a small crew, do you feel it a little more freeing when you're doing Soundtracker and touring than with a rock band? And, you know, you feel, a lot of people ask me all the time, like, oh, you must see the sights and you must you must have seen this and that. It took me 9 visits to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, I know, man.
People don't get it.
It's with Soundtracker, it's different, but the same. It's like there's 5 of us traveling around. We actually count our band hours. Because we pull in like maybe 16-hour days every day. And for example, in India, we were there for 9 days and we clocked in, I think, 56 hours sitting in a van. So it's a lot of the same. In Jakarta and Indonesia, it's the traffic is so bad that we went from the hotel we shot this death metal, kind of Indonesian death metal band. And who, by the way, had their own ghost with them. It was fucking hysterical. It was amazing. Anyways, it took us 3.5 hours to get there. And then when the traffic had stopped, we had finished filming around midnight, 1 o'clock. We drove back to the hotel. It took us 15 minutes.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a lot of the same. But we get to see a little bit more and different things, but it's the same thing. It's kind of like work and rush from one place to the other, and you basically see where you're at.
But in a way, you get to take in the city and the country that you're in a little more than when you're touring in a band, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Very kind of spoiled and different way. I really get kind of deep into it. It's really, I don't know how to even explain it. It's not even the same if I went just on a holiday to India, you know, and just like, you know, backpacked around or something and went from one place to the other. It's not even the same. It's like, it's so intense. It takes me like a week to like digest everything I just heard and seen and experienced and the interviews. And, you know, we were in Colombia, we were up in the mountains in the FARC area and interviewing refugees and who were actually musicians and hearing their stories about the Civil War, you know, from the horse's mouth. It's kind of, you know, shocking at the moment when it happens and you interview and this old lady is telling you what's been going on in her life. And you kind of just, then after that, you move on to the next interview or next place and, you know, pack your van and leave. And then you do the same thing again. So you do a week, 12 days of that. It's just kind of like your brain's completely fucking scrambled. You come back home, you're like, what the hell happened? You know what I mean?
Right. It's like heavy moment after heavy moment after heavy moment.
Yeah, and an amazing, you know, performances, you know, musically, you just go completely like, what the fuck, you know, this kind of music exists. You know, it's really amazing.
Is there like a break between trips? Like obviously one trip is like an episode, but do you go from country to country or do you get time at home and then go?
Yeah, it's we did the first season. We did that in the span of over a year.
Okay.
Because it was the first one and we just kind of like we were trying out things and the travels took about a year and then there was the editing and, you know, post-production and all that. But the second season that we did, we narrowed it down that we travel all the trips in half a year and then do all the editing during the summer and then it comes out in the fall. And we're doing the same thing this year. We did in January, early January one trip, early February 2nd. Now we have a little bit of time off and then we're doing kind of back to back, Japan and Russia. There's only like a 10-day, 10 days off between those two trips, and then 10 days off, and then we go to Ireland. It's kind of hectic.
First episode started off with a bang, the inaugural Soundtracker episode. As a fan, I gotta bring it up. You went deep, but then you ended with the only person you have to end with when you do a show on New York City, David Johansen, who I've got a framed picture of him up on my on the hallway of my place, eating a bowl of cornflakes at an art gallery. Like, David Johansen to me is a big deal. I met the guy once and he was very nice to me. And you end the first episode, you were in the New York Dolls, which is huge. I can't not talk to you now that I have your attention and ask you about your connection with the Dolls. I gotta ask.
Well, it kind of goes way back. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I loved them. You know, it's like I had Diamond Dogs on one side of the cassette tape and then the Dolls' first album on the other. And so, you know, and Hanoi was influenced by them. So those, you know, and then I got to know Johnny Thunders in the early 80s and played in a trio with him and Jerry Nolan. And when the Dolls got back together in 2004, they only did one show with Arthur, with Arthur and with Arthur Killer Kane, the original bass player, and they had some touring already booked that they couldn't get out of contractually, or it would have been a mess. So they thought that they will just do the Little Stevens Randall's Island Festival and a Japanese tour, and then there was some festival dates with White Stripes and Peaches that they were booked to do. So I heard from a friend who used to play with Sylvain, Psycho Sluts from Hell guitar player, Donna. She called me up and said that Syl's looking for me. And I met Syl a couple of times, so we got along really good. And, you know, she was asking for my phone number for Syl. And Sylvain called me and was like, "Hey, Jackson, want to do some gigs?" I thought, well, yes, I do. And but I had to audition because Johansen didn't know anything about Hanoi or me or anything about that. So I had to go in and play those songs. And I knew all the, you know, the whole, I know their back catalog in my, you know, in my sleep, you know, right. It's just like ingrained in my DNA. And I just had to kind of like remind myself what key those songs go from. And I went to the audition and I got to play literally the whole first album with David and Syl. I was happy with that. I was just like, if it ended right here, it's fine.
Yeah.
Fucking first record with them, you know. And I did those shows with them and in the sound checks and the couple of rehearsals that we did, we started coming up with ideas and riffs and a song or two. And we kind of just realized that, you know, maybe this has got some legs and everybody was having a good time together. It was a very good vibe in the band. And it turned into be 6 years with them. It was one of the most amazing things ever happened in my life.
Yeah. Wow. That's,
yeah.
I through a mutual friend, Gary Taxali, who's an illustrator here in Toronto, he's friends with Sylvain, and Sylvain played in Toronto, and JC and I went for lunch with Sylvain and Gary.
Oh, right on.
I had the first two New York Dolls albums in my bag for Sylvain to sign, but I was too chicken shit to take him out and have him sign it.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But he's very nice.
Yeah, nice. Sylvain, yeah. Best. I just did a tour about like 9 months ago in Spain with Syl. It's I got Stevie Klassen and Chris Musto, who played in Thundersea's last band, the Oddballs, to play guitar and drums, and me on bass and Silvano guitar. And we just did a short, I think it was 5 dates, in Madrid and Barcelona and Galicia and the Basque Country. We did just a short tour and played Dolls and Sylvain's, you know, solo material, which was freaking amazing. Had the best time. It's me and Silas totally in contact, and same thing with David.
Wow.
Funniest guys on earth, man. I swear to God, it's like being on the road with those guys. It's like being with Abbott and Costello, man. It's absolutely hysterical.
Oh, yeah, amazing. I mean, you know, they say don't meet your heroes, but I took a chance, and we were playing in Bergen in Norway at this festival, and David Johansen was playing another club, and I went to a sound check and I asked him if I could do an interview with him.
Yeah.
And he was so gracious to me. Thank God. It was amazing. It was the last show of his tour, so he was in a good mood. But I finished the interview with him and I had to run across town to our club. I got into my stage gear and then just walked on stage. And then I got on stage and I go, I just met David Johansen. That's great. Yeah.
That interview with him was really amazing. We're going to put it out at one point, the whole thing, because it was almost an hour. It was like 50 minutes. He just rattled his entire life from like the moment he heard the first song in the backseat of his dad's car, you know, in early 50s. And it's just unbelievable. He just opened up and just told his story. It's really, really amazing.
Well, to me, David Johansen is the ultimate what people call rock star. Not just some, you know, Dionysian lunkhead who's just in it for simple kicks. To me, I've only met him once, but to me, he signifies the ultimate rock star in sophistication, intellectual, but also can get down to the nitty gritty. That to me is the consummate rock star.
Yeah, absolutely. And his head is wide open to all music. That's part of the reason why I got along with him so well too. We would give each other tapes. I mean, CDs of all kinds of. I gave him some this Bosnian gypsy woman Liliana Butler CD, and freaked out on that. And then he gave me some Tunisian wedding music. You know, like we bonded with that.
That's great. I mean, that's going back to Soundtracker. That's the best part about your approach to kind of world music. I hate to say world music because it just lumps everything together. But
it's really bad because it makes you think of, you know, things in certain ways. It's kind of like a guy with the dreads and a funny hat on and round glasses in a way. You know what I mean? It's I think it's a really unfortunate labeling for
I really don't like it, but I mean, it's the only way I can differentiate what, you know, the rock and roll and the Western music in a very concise way, but I hate to use the term, but when people talk about musics from other countries, let's just say that, it's always with like kind of like a hands off. Oh, it's divine. It's pristine. Oh, but you kind of get in there and you're like, no, this is like raw. This is real. This is rugged. That's what I like about Soundtracker too.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a punk rock attitude to the whole thing. It's we didn't go there seeking out the biggest stars of each place. You know, it's like, you know, if we can get some kind of a legend, fine, we'll take him. You know, but we want to kind of like cover everything from, you know, street musicians to anything in between, and what's the past of the place and where is it heading and what is the fusing of things. And, you know, in Senegal we ended up in the middle of the desert with a group of female drummers. You know, some of them had used shotgun shells in their fingers so they can get a louder, you know, sound out of their drums, and it was, you know, just manic stuff like that. And I think Clash has got a lot to do with what I'm doing, you know, Joe Strummer and Clash, seriously.
I understand what you mean by that.
Yeah, it's they kind of open up my mind and head to a lot of things, you know, political stuff. And because all these episodes, they also talk about the social issues of the place, you know, depending on where we are. And usually you get the truth, you know, some kind of a truth from the musician's mouth. We were in Turkey about a year and a half ago, and every single musician over there went political on me, like within 2 minutes, even the belly dancer.
Right, you know? Right, yeah.
Yeah. And it's really, you really get a feel of the place by listening to the people who live in the middle of it and tell it. It's all you got to ask is like, well, how is it being a musician in your country? You know, depending on what they do. And you know, they all have a story to tell. So it's kind of like mixing the social stuff with music and hopefully kind of like open a door for the audiences to see that. You know, that there's this amazing music all around the world, and at the end of the day, we're all the same, you know, that doesn't have to be so divided.
Well, I think positioning you as the host and the guide makes it very palatable for, you know, people like me who come from kind of a Western rock and roll kind of background to check in with all these scenes. I mean, yeah, the intense moments that you guys managed to capture give me interest in what's being covered.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's funny. A couple of weeks ago, we were in Finland. Jyväskylä and Kopio, and you are playing with Michael Monroe, and your face was following us. So it was just, I don't know. You've been in my kind of circle for the past month and 2 months since 2017. It's year of Jaffa.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And in scheduling this talk with you, you're saying you're doing some gigs on the side, like on the weekends with Michael Monroe. So is that what you're doing in between seasons?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we try to schedule. We have a pretty hardcore touring schedule with Michael, especially in the summer and usually in the spring as well. And you know, we go to Japan and we go to UK, we do Europe and we do Scandinavia. So it's I always try to schedule in between, and it turns out to be pretty hardcore traveling for me, but they're both things that I love to do, and Michael is like my brother, and we still keep putting out good records, so it's love doing it. It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's great to see you guys still out there doing it. I know you've been with Michael for during his solo jaunt for many years now with Dragon and Ginger and Steve Conti. That's how I met you, the backstage at the Backyard Baby show. So you're still in touch with everybody, and it's great.
So everybody who's been in the band, they're like brothers. It's I can't do one TV performance here in Finland for the new single because I'm in Far East. So Dragon's going to play bass.
No shit. That's great.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's really, that's great. Well, man, I don't want to keep you any longer. This has been a great talk. I mean, you know, we can always go deeper and deeper, but I'd love to bring you back on like after I've consumed the other seasons. And when is season 3 going to be out?
That's coming out this September, October.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and there's Art House Music from Germany that puts out our both seasons on DVD now, and it's all in English narration and English subtitles and all that. So you can go to the Soundtracker, Sammy Jaffa Soundtracker Facebook site, and you can order them through that.
And I heard that it just won some awards, right?
Yeah, he won the two like equivalent Emmys over here in Finland for the best music program and the best, I guess, current affairs program,
right?
Social program, yeah. So both seasons won a little statue for me.
Yeah. Well, maybe on season 7 or season 8 of Soundtracker, you'll come up north to Canada and do an episode.
Exactly. We go to Saskatchewan and, you know, drink some beers and play some Neil Young, man. Let's do that.
I could hip you to a couple of musicians or groups that would probably blow your mind, man.
Yeah, no, Canada is deep, man. You know, it's so we actually thought about already doing that and going all the way up north to Inuit people and then just like trek down from there.
That would be pretty heavy, yeah. Well, it's great, man, just great meeting up with you and chatting with you through Skype, the wonders of Skype. But it's only lucky, you know, the fates wanted this episode to happen. I had to run into you.
Absolutely, man. It was so good to see you again, man.
Now, if the fates are working this way where I can watch a show and then the person comes, I'm going to go now and watch a whole bunch of Kylie Minogue videos, okay? Oh my God, Kylie, what are you doing here?
Brilliant.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sammy. Thank you.
My brother. Thanks a lot, Danko.
All right, man.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.